from last week, you mean? Let's begin by remembering where we are in the story. We're looking at Joshua. Remember how Joshua led Israel over into the Promised Land, over the Jordan River, and how they had that amazing victory over Jordan or over Jericho, you know, when the walls came down and all of that. And then right on the heels of that, they go up against Ai, and nothing goes right at all. They lose 36 guys, and this much smaller city just routs them, sends them packing, running away down the hill. And so when they inquire of the Lord, they find out, well, man, there was a guy in the camp who had actually had a stash of apostasy that he had with him, and he was one ruining the whole thing for them. So they dealt with that, and once they dealt with that, the Lord gave them a plan as to how they would take Ai. Remember, it was going to be an ambush thing. So they went about it a completely different way, and they had a great victory. And we covered all those events last week. And then the very funny. And then at the end of the chapter of chapter 8, if you remember, the thank you, my lovely assistant. I could still wing it. I think I could. Anyway, at the end of chapter 8, remember they set up the altar that the Lord had commanded them to set up back in Deuteronomy chapter 27 and 28, and the altar on the top of Mount Ebal. And that's where we left off last week. All of Israel had gathered below these two mountains, and they were going over all of the law. So with that in mind, that's where we begin here. We start here in verse 1 of chapter 9. Right on the heels of them saying that they set up this altar and they did all of this and they read the law to the whole assembly. And it came to pass, verse 1, when all the kings who were on this side of the Jordan, that is on the west side of the Jordan, in the hills and in the lowland, and in all the coasts of the great sea towards Lebanon, the Hittite, the Amorite, the Canaanite, the Perizzite, the Hivite, the Jebusite, heard about it, that they gathered together to fight with Joshua and Israel with one accord. Okay, so here we have, on the heels of this great moment of victory for Israel, the news of this is getting out to everybody around. Here, Israel is worshiping God and going over his laws at the base of these two mountains there. And at the same time as they're worshiping the Lord, the news of this is spreading out throughout all of the land of Palestine. And so the people who dwell in those cities, you know, they're hearing about this, you know, bang, 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 all these kings are falling. And, you know, it's not even just Jericho. It was leading up to that. Remember all the other battles that they had with Og and some of the others as they were coming in there. So the kings of that region, all the people of that region are putting it all together. This is not, you know, this is not a test. This is for real. These guys are moving in, and these guys mean business, and they're taking no prisoners. And so we're going to have to stop this. And there's only one thing we can do, and that is form a huge alliance and gather everybody together and go out there and meet them. So that's what they do. And so obviously some time has passed, because not, you know, you don't throw something together like this, especially in that day and age, overnight. You don't just, you know, get on the phone and call everybody or send out emails everywhere and get all the armies together. And I mean, even now, back in when we had a lot of nations in alliance with us when during the first Gulf War, remember what it took to get all of those nations together and make that concerted effort. I mean, that's a big deal. You have these kings gathering in dark councils, determining that they're going to stop Israel, but then they've got to get all of their armies together and march them that way. So we get a sense of time elapsing here. Israel's moved into the Promised Land area. They've gone to the west side of the Jordan now. Now they're getting set up. They're more than likely occupying all this territory now that was the territory of Jericho and now the territory of Ai. And so they're setting up their camp and they're making some fortifications to get ready. But now the word is coming to them that there is a huge army, a gathered army of all these nations moving in on a frontal assault, just getting them out. And out there and ready to set up, more than likely to set up a vanguard. We don't get the sense that there's an immediate frontal assault on Israel, but they're bringing out their armies to make it clear to Israel, we're not amused. We're not into this at all. All right, so then we go on. I'm coming back to my notes. I was winging it, but I'm going to just stick with this. That way I don't, because even winging it, what I did was just gave you way more information than you needed, and I didn't have nearly any of that here. And so I could have saved you all of that from, so I'm going to protect you a little bit and stick with this. So let's pick up now the story in verse 3. But when the inhabitants of Gibeon heard what Joshua had done to Jericho and Ai, they worked craftily and went and pretended to be ambassadors. And they took old sacks on their donkeys, old wineskins, torn and mended, you know, torn and sewed up, old and patched sandals on their feet and old garments on themselves, and all the bread of their provision was dry and moldy. And they went to Joshua to the camp at Gilgal and said to him and to the men of Israel, "We have come from a far country. Now therefore, make a covenant with us." All right, so whereas all these other nations are deciding they're going to deal with this as a frontal assault, we're going to get these guys, we're going to get band together, get a big allied force together, and we're going to go out there and set up a vanguard and stop these guys from coming any further. The Gibeonites use a completely different tactic. And what they do, they clearly looked at this situation and assessed it quite properly. They looked at it and realized, okay, wait a minute. They've come through. Nothing has stopped them yet. Something is on their side. They're saying it's the Lord their God. At this point, what are we going to do to argue with that? Obviously, there's a God at work for these Israelites, and he's making things happen, and I don't see that we have much of a chance in this whole thing. If Jericho fell the way it fell, and all these other places fell, the superpowers that were to the south of us, how in the world are we going to get this? And so, you know, they decided there must be something to this God, and they realized that there was no way in the world that they were going to be able to face them in open combat and be able to succeed. So they go about, instead of joining up with all the armies that are part of these other nations that are gathering together, you notice that they were absent from that list of the ones that were gathering together. Instead of joining up with that army and sending their ambassadors that way, they grab their ambassadors and send them towards Israel with a different plan in mind. What they do is they go down and they get the nastiest stuff. They go down to the Goodwill and they pick out all the nasty, awful stuff from the 70s and everything like that. And they put all this stuff on and it's gnarly looking. And they get the oldest cars that they can find, all junky and beat up. And they go driving off to Israel to meet up with the Israelites there. And they come in and they just look like, you know, hobos coming in off the street. And they come in and represent themselves in a way that is, well, it's not at all true. They pull into Israel's camp and they tell Joshua that they're from a far off country. You know, they're from a great distance. Now they do this because, and we'll find this out later on as the story unfolds, but they do this because the word has gotten out that their leader, Moses, had given them instructions that they're to go in and wipe out the inhabitants of the land. So, you know, they're not that stupid. I mean, they're putting this all together. We can't let them know that we're from around here. You ain't from around here, are you? No, we're not at all. We're way out. We're from Weewaw. We don't have anything to do with this area around here. So they're, you know, they go in there and they're trying to put together a treaty. Look at this. Whereas the other kings are putting together a massive army to prepare themselves for a full-out frontal assault, the Gibeonites sit down with the gears turning and think, no, we need to go get ourselves a treaty with the future owners of Palestine because we see where this is going and we need to preserve ourselves. And so, they, you know, instead of trying to outright attack them, they deceive them. They have this false appearance and they have these straight up lies that they tell them. We're from a far off place. Well, no, they're not. But they tell them this. They're doing this out of self-preservation. They want to stay alive. They don't want to die. They've heard the reports of all these other things that have happened, the downfall of Jericho. They're going to do what is necessary in order to survive this. They know what's coming for them. They've seen it. They know what's going to happen if something doesn't intervene on their behalf. If somehow this doesn't turn around in their favor. All right, so we pick up here then in verse 7. Then the men of Israel said to the Hivites, "Perhaps you dwell among us, so how can we make a covenant with you?" But they said to Joshua, "We are your servants." And Joshua said to them, "Who are you, and where do you come from?" So they said to him, "From a very far country your servants have come, because of the name of the Lord your God. For we heard of his fame and all that he did in Egypt, and all that he did to the two kings of the Amorites who were beyond the Jordan, to Sihon, king of Heshbon, and Og, king of Bashan, who was at Ashtaroth. Therefore our elders and all the inhabitants of our country spoke to us, saying, 'Take provisions with you for the journey and go and meet them, and say to them, we are your servants. Now therefore, make a covenant with us. This bread of ours we took hot for our provision from our houses on the day we departed to come to you. But now look, it's dry and moldy, and these wineskins which were filled were new, and see, they're torn, and these are garments, and our sandals and our chevys have become old because of this very long journey. Okay, so here they come in and they're given this pretty good story. I mean, you notice this, that right in the midst, though, of these outright lies that the Gibeonites are telling to the people of Israel, do you notice anything about some of the stuff that they're saying in there? I mean, right off the bat, they seem to have the same kind of belief that Rahab had. You notice that? How they talk about the fame of what has happened and how God has delivered these nations into your hands and stuff. It was the same kind of stuff that Rahab was saying to the two spies when they came into Jericho. And she was right away. Remember, we went over that she didn't have a complete knowledge. She didn't have a complete understanding of who this God was, but she certainly had a faith that was driving her. There is something about this God that troubles me, that draws me to him, that makes me want to find peace with him before I'm ruined by him. And so that's what they're doing. They're acknowledging God. They refer to him as Lord, the Lord your God. They refer to him as your God, but they are still referring to him as Lord when they refer to God. So I think that's a pretty insightful bit of information as to what was happening. I mean, we see again how God is magnified, how he gets glory when he begins to move in the lives of the Israelites and he begins to fight for them and they begin to trust him to deal with their battles and to fight on their behalf. Well, man, then things happen and the Lord is glorified as a result of it. The Israel becomes his testimony. And of course, that's true with all of us. That's true in all of our lives, that we are God's Bible to this world. We are the testimony of the Lord and how he navigates us through the issues of life. And so they're, the Gibeonites are launching out. There's something about this that I just really like. I mean, the Gibeonites are launching out in faith, not with full knowledge, but with faith that somehow that if they approach this to try to make a treaty, to try to make a covenant with this God, that they will somehow be preserved. And I don't know what it is, but I just have an affinity for these guys. Not many commentators do, so I might be wrong about that. But to me, when I look at this, I get the same kind of sense that I got from Rahab, this idea that even though she didn't know this God that well, she didn't have a complete understanding, there was something about him that she knew she had to get right with him or else face the consequences of it. And that's what these Gibeonites are doing if you break it down and look at what they're doing. All right, verse 14. Then the men of Israel took some of their provisions, but they didn't ask counsel of the Lord. So Joshua made peace with them and made a covenant with them to let them live. And the rulers of the congregation swore to them. Okay, now, it's weird, but it's very human that the very thing that Israel got in trouble for back at Ai was that they launched off. Remember what happened back there? They got done with this great victory in Jericho, and they say, okay, well, let's go get Ai, and this will be great. And they only take off with 3,000 guys, and they never ask the Lord anything. And they go up, and they get defeated, and they're faced with all this trouble again. And so, like I said, it's a very human thing, but maybe you could learn from those mistakes. But instead of asking counsel of the Lord, they look at the outward evidence that they see in front of them. Well, it looks right, and their story, makes sense to me. So, well, we'll just go with that. And so that's what they do. And back at the Battle of Ai, if they would have asked the Lord his counsel, maybe he would have spared 36 men. Maybe had they asked him, he would have said, no, don't go fight them yet, because you got a problem with Achan over there. You need to deal with that before you go out there and put your men at risk. And things might have gone differently. There might have been 36 families who didn't lose a father or a husband or a brother or something along those lines, had they stopped and asked the Lord. But here again, they turn right around and make the same mistake. They look at these guys, at the outward evidence, a plausible story, and they just like, well, cool, come on, yeah, let's go do this. That's a great idea. And it says that they looked at the bread, and they looked at all the stuff that they had, the bread, they looked at the wear on the tires, and they judged the whole thing by its outward appearance. And boy, couldn't you just spend a whole lot of time just even talking about that? How much stock we put in outward evidence of things. How much stock we as human beings, it's not even just a Western thing, it is a human thing that we love empirical evidence. We just love it. We're fascinated with it. We crave it. We're constantly looking for it. And boy, if we got something right in front of us, well, what else do we need? I mean, it's right there. Why would I need to do anything else? And that's basically what they were doing in this. I mean, you know, well, it looks right and it sounds right. What else is there? Oh, well, yeah, there is prayer, but, you know, why bother God about this? This is obvious. We just go on and do what we're going to do. And how many times have we been in situations like that? You know, no, let's just make a covenant with these guys, bind ourselves to them with an oath. That'll be fine. That's a great idea. And then they face the trouble that they're going to face, or the difficulty that they're going to face. It's one of these things. It's one of these curious things where God even still works his plans through even bad choices that we end up making at times. And, you know, so these guys, it seems so obvious. It seems like the right thing to do. Why bother God about this? And they launch off. But the thing that I think is interesting to me in this little passage here is what's not in here. And that is, you notice how absent God is from this whole thing. Not only is he absent from their minds in the sense that they didn't inquire of him, but God, I mean, this would have been a great time for God to jump in there, you know, with the smoke and the fire thing that he does and gets everybody's attention. What a cool time that he could have done that. You know, hey, don't do it. They're tricking you. Oh, well, you realize that every single one of the Israelites there would have believed that. Nobody would have questioned that. They would have said, yeah, you're right. Okay, well, go get them. We're sorry. We won't make any covenant with these guys at all for any reason. But God doesn't do that. God doesn't try to prevent them from making this choice that they're determined they're going to make without asking his counsel. I mean, you know, he lets them do that. And I think that he let them do that because they left him out of their decision-making process. That's just kind of the way God seems to do things. God isn't always, and this could come as a shock to you, and I don't want to bother you here, but God isn't always trying to make sure that everything is just okay and comfortable for us. I'm not sure if you're aware of that, but I mean, God's highest goal, and you know, it's hard for us as Americans to really believe that, but God's greatest goal in our lives is not to make sure that everything is going okay for us, or that we're very comfortable, or that, you know, God isn't always that interested in saving us from trouble. And what I mean by that is that, you know, he's concerned about who we become in this journey. You realize that's what this is all about. What we face, what we go through, God is working something towards our character. He's trying to draw us back to what we were meant to be. We were born, remember the phrase? We were born a long way from where we were meant to be. And we're on our way home. God's purpose in this journey is to draw us into the character that he originally intended for us to have, a character like his. We're made in his image. We're to be like him. That's his goal. That's his purpose in all of these things. And when it comes to decisions that we make in life and the choices that are there, well, the fact of the matter is there are some good choices that we can make, and there are some really bad choices that we can make, and there's a very real road of pain in between those things. And there are many times in life that God isn't just jumping in there and stopping us from making certain decisions or trying to get us off that path. Sometimes he'll let us take that road, just so that we can learn, so that we can find something else out about ourselves, even about him as we go along, so that he can perfect in us that character that he so longs for us to have. Because we got to always remember, he's out to capture our hearts. You know that. That's what he's after. Every decision, this was a very important detail that just got thrown in there. They weren't just trying to, well, you know, how many verses do we have in this chapter? 27. We better, you know, throw another one in there just to make sure it's filled out. They weren't doing that. There's a real reason why this is included in the story. They looked at the evidence and they didn't include God in their decision-making process. And all of life, I mean, everything that we are facing, everything we go through, everything that comes before us. And I'm telling you, I mean, when I say everything, do you mean everything, Rob? I do mean everything. Everything is supposed to have God as its center. Yeah, but what, you know, like when I'm standing there deciding what toothpaste to buy, Rob, is that what you're talking about? You know what I'm talking about, obviously, when we're talking about the decisions of life. But even there, you could, you know, keep God at the center of it and, you know, make your decisions, you know, Lord, keep my teeth bright and shiny, happy, clean, or whatever. But the point is that God on all these decisions, these major decisions that we have to make that will express who we are. Because that's what happens in life decisions. Those life decisions that we make will express who we are and define us as we go along. God wants to be at the center of those. God wants to be the motivating force. When we determine, just like here in this case, should we make an alliance with these guys? Well, it looks good. Let's just do it. What God is wanting to be in our lives is that motivating, that driving force. But what would God want us to do in this situation? And it's not always easy to tell. It's not always just the surface stuff that we look at. Sometimes we need to take the time and find out from the Lord, what do you want with this? Now, sometimes we're not going to get a clear leading. We've gone over that before. Why God does it that way, I don't know. But we make the choices.